About that activism and the nature of it. There have been many people who have really risked their own personal safety in climbing up on the bulldozers, chaining themselves to the bulldozers. Now, as I mentioned, there is a group that is facing felony charges. I mean, this could be tens of thousands of dollars in fines and possible sentences of years in prison if they are convicted. What do you think this represents for authorities to start charging people with felonies?
Well, we've already seen an inappropriate escalation by the law enforcement, by the very fact that they've brought in the National Guard, and that in the past couple of arrests that they've made, they've had police officers on site with semi-automatic rifles to deal with water protectors who are unarmed, who are merely there to an act of civil disobedience. So we've already seen this absurd escalation of law enforcement reaction. We've seen this escalation of Dakota Access bringing in security, their own private security force, with their own attack dogs to sic on unarmed protesters, unarmed water protectors, and the usage of mace upon, you know, a crowd of women and children and men. So it's absurd. And so it just add to it now, you have the court system, who is escalating their own form of absurdity by pushing for felony charges. And the thing that's really crazy about this is that what the charge that they're advocating for is reckless endangerment, because they're stating that police officers are put in danger when they're trying to remove water protectors who are locked down, who are chained to machinery. So there's no really consideration of like the danger that the water protector themselves may be in, or any consideration that, you know, that this entire pipeline is considered a reckless endangerment to entire communities all across, not only in the Midwest, but all those communities downstream.
And Dallas, do they justify not charging the security guards who unleashed dogs on protesters? I understand a little girl was bitten in the chest. People were bitten in their face. I mean, and so far I understand there have been no charges or even really acknowledgement that something criminal took place.
Well, I think that one thing I clear up, there was not a little girl that was bit. There was a pregnant woman. So I don't know if it's any worse or any bad,
see.
But there
okay.
was.
Okay, thank you.
It was a pregnant woman that was bitten. I can't fathom the reasoning behind not moving ahead with charges on this company. There, I think there was one positive thing that come out is that the securities board, the North Dakota agency that regulates private security forces, is doing an investigation into the organization this company that has been offering private security to Dakota Access. Where that investigation is at, I don't know. We don't know how in depth they're going to go, or what the approach, or what the potential outcome could be. But at least I think that there's at least an acknowledgement from their side of things that an investigation needs to happen. You know, it's absurd that the police did not step in. The police were on site. The police arrived at the incident when there was a dog attacks upon, you know, our water protectors. The police did arrive a little bit later, but they chose to stay behind. They were parked, you know, within like 200-300 yards away. I'm unsure whether they were able to see the actual dog attacks, but they were there, and they also made it very known that they were not going to do any arrests at that point. So it is disgusting to see the language and the narrative that the state of North Dakota and the Morton County Sheriff use to paint this image as though this peaceful camp that's based on prayer being framed as violent protesters or angry mob or rioters. And all it does, the only good that it serves, is to build this narrative that they need the National Guard to come in, or that they need more money to provide for materials, or potentially, you know, their own types of weapons to use on protectors down the road. Mm-hmm. So it's disgusting, and it's really disturbing, and it's very, very sad that we still have to deal with this, that we still have to deal with the image of dogs being used on water protectors in this day. It's disgusting.
The protests are getting higher profile, a little bit more attention now. Bernie Sanders has come out against them and is apparently going to make an appearance. And of course, President Obama was asked while he was in Laos over the weekend about it. He made a very vague statement, didn't really directly address the protests other than to say that his administration has done more than previous administrations for Native communities in general. But I'm wondering whether you think that this effort that began all the way back in April is going to be successful, particularly given your role in the Keystone XL pipeline protests. Those were huge protests, and people really, really didn't, I think, feel that they were going to have the kind of victory that they did. So given your experience with Keystone, what is your hope for the DAPL?
My hope, and I have a firm belief that we will be able to accomplish this hope, is that this pipeline will not be completed, that there will be no oil transported from the Bakken oil fields down to Patoka, Illinois, and that we'll have another victory, an immense victory, for the greater climate justice movement and for the movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground. That I have faith in those that are dedicated on the ground to fight this pipeline. I have faith in the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, who has gone through a legal strategy to try to halt the construction of this pipeline. We're in a time right now where we're not talking about not in my backyard or more sustainable methods of construction or development. The only realistic solution to addressing climate change and to protect our communities is to keep fossil fuels in the ground and to see a rapid just transition towards localized renewable energy production. That is where our goal is. That is where I have all my, that's where I'm putting all my chips in. That's where we are dedicated to fight for, you know, and I think that in the path of that, I think that civil disobedience plays a major part in that. Good, strong legal action plays a major part in that. Good political strategies play a big part in that, and that's what we're seeing. This convergence, much like how we saw in Keystone XL, but the biggest difference is in this case, they're actually putting pipeline into the ground. You have our political allies who are stepping up to the plate, like Bernie Sanders, like you have a lot of our representatives in the Progressive Democratic Caucus who've all been stepping up to the plate to support this effort. You also have our more the media strategy that's been developed, and we have a lot of famous people, celebrities who are stepping up, you know, getting our message out there is a big part of it. And then we have our action strategy, where it's people literally putting their bodies on the line to occupy space to delay construction.
And also, Dallas, every there's been independent media at Dakota Access Pipeline protests too. People, of course, groups like Democracy Now! Came through, and I understand Amy Goodman herself is facing charges, but a lot of indigenous media as well at the protest site for weeks now, right? That's also pretty important.
No, it's correct. I think that independent media is basically what's keeping this, what's sparked this fire and is keeping it going. It's independent media from the outside, but also a major part of our strategy is creating our own content, creating our own media for ourselves and for our allies. I think that's a major part of this strategy. That if you're on Facebook, or we have a Facebook page, the Sacred Stone Camp, our Camp of the Sacred Stones. It's our primary outlet for content that we're generating ourselves from the camp. So rather than waiting for CNN to talk about what's happening in the camp, you can go right into social media and see what we are saying that's happening in the camp. And that's a vital difference. And that's kind of controlling, making sure that we are controlling the narrative that goes out, but also are accountable for our actions. And that that this camp that is predicated on the belief of prayer and peace will accomplish its goals wholeheartedly without any distraction from the outside media who try to spin it any other way. So, you know, I think that's the beautiful time we're in right now, is we have this ability to control that story and to put it out on our own terms.
And Dallas, I mentioned you were recently profiled by the Los Angeles Times. And had I not seen this article, I might not have known that in addition to your activism with the Indigenous Environmental Network, you're also a sketch comic, the profile an environmental activist who uses comedy to help stop oil pipelines. Can you tell me a little bit about the comedy work that you do and how, in a way, that becomes a vehicle for your activism?
It was really crazy, the LA Times thing. I was not expecting that, and you know, whenever I do my organizing, whenever I, you know, if I'm speaking and doing, you know, working with mobilizing communities and mass groups, like humor is a natural part of what I do. Like I think that it's a cliche statement, but it's very true that laughter is medicine, and that I actively choose as an organizer, as I don't even know if I call myself a leader, but as an organizer, I really want to push back against this identity that in order to be an organizer, you have to be angry. You have to work out as a reactionary approach. And I actively choose against that, that I'm proactive in my approach to working with my community. And I actively choose to use humor and laughter and a lighthearted approach as a means to bring about the change I want to see. I work with a group called the 1491s. This is my t-shirt right here.
Cool.
You can check us out on YouTube. We have our own YouTube channel where we do sketch comedy from a very strictly indigenous perspective. It's really targeting we target the outsider looking in just as much as we target the insider looking within. Mm-hmm. It's a satirical approach to the world around us. And so when I, in my organizing, like I said, whenever I work with communities, like if I have a microphone, I'm going to try to make people laugh. That's just a given. And I try my very best. I fail often, but I try.
How does one joke about something so serious?
You would be surprised at how satirical and cynical Native people are. And you'd be surprised of how often humor and laughter is a mechanism for which our survival depends on. You think that, you know, you think about, go back, think about this. Think about every black and white photo from the 1800s of a Native person. I guarantee you about 90% of the time, immediately after they took that stoic photo, they were smiling or they're laughing. I think that comedy and laughter is one of the primary means of why we are still here today as Indigenous peoples, because we're able to make light of the world around us and not get wrapped up into this total tunnel vision of doom. And I think that's what has allowed us to survive.
Do you take on stereotypes of Native peoples in your comedy? Because we live in a country today where Native communities are invisibilized, right? Mainstream non-Native communities often see Native communities through these horrific stereotypes rooted in historic colonialism. People showing up to, wearing Native garb as a costume that they can just take off and put on even if they have no ancestry. Is that something that you use as fodder for comedy?
Oh, yes. I think that there is so much comedic fodder out there about how Native people are perceived, but also how we as Native people perceive ourselves. And I think that, our comedy and my comedy is not limited just to one of those fields. I think that it's just, there's so much content out there to pull from to just make light of. And I think that, you know, this whole mysticism, oh, you're so sacred, Indian people, I got my crystals, and like this is just hilarious. And like, I love to poke fun at those individuals that over romanticize us as Native people, just as much as I like to make fun of our own Native people that over romanticize ourselves. I think that it comes down to this, is that, you know, and I said it in the LA Times interview, was just that society is lazy, that media is lazy, and that it tries its very best to minimize the content or the breadth of one's identity to the most simplest of terms, and we have to reject it as much as possible and not be afraid to make a complex narrative about who we are, and which is mainly we're not just angry Indians, that we can laugh and smile at the same time.
Right, we are all so much more complex than that, and particularly people of color have overlapping identities that form who we are. Dallas, what's a website where people can find out more about your sketch comedy?
You can check out the 1491s on Facebook and also on YouTube, 1491s. No apostrophe, you can check us out there.
And we'll post links to it, as well as the Facebook page that you mentioned off the Sacred Stone Camp. Dallas, thank you so much for all your work and for spending this time with us today.
I thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I want you to know that This is a clean shirt, but I am just wearing some old sweatpants right now. Just want to let you know. All right. Being honest. Right?
And for
I did this for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Clean shirt for the TV interview. And for our radio audience, you can check out the TV version of this interview on our website. Dallas, thank you so much.
Yeah, folks, and check out indigenousrising.org as another resource for the activism work. Indigenousrising.org. Thank you.
We'll post all of those links on our website. My guest, Dallas Goldtooth, is the Keep It in the Ground campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network and a member of the sketch comedy group, the 1491s. He was recently profiled by the LA Times. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/ruwithsonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/ruwithsonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/ruwithsonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a current KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm/2016 Board of Directors. Or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is October 15th. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply